countless other species. Remove the snag and kill the woodpecker who keeps in check the weevils that would kill the other trees. She describes the droops and racemes, panicles and involucres that a person could walk past for a lifetime and never notice. She tells how the woody-coned alders harvest gold, how an inch-high pecan might have 6 feet of root, how the inner bark of birches can feed the starving, how one hop-hornbeam catkin holds several million grains of pollen, how indigenous fishermen used to crush walnut leaves to stun and catch fish, how willows clean soils of dioxins, PCBs, and heavy metals. She lays out how fungal hyphae, countless miles of filaments folded up in every spoon of soil, coax open tree roots and tap into them, how the wired-up fungi feed the tree minerals, how the tree pays for these nutrients with sugars, which the fungi can't make. Something marvelous is happening underground, something we're just learning how to see. Mats of mycorrhizal cabling link trees into gigantic, smart communities spread across hundreds of acres. Together, they form vast trading networks of goods, services, and information. There are no individuals in a forest, no separable events. The bird and the branch it sits on are a joint thing. A third or more of the food a big tree makes may go to feed other organisms. Even different kinds of trees form partnerships. Cut down a birch and a nearby Douglas fir may suffer. In the great forests of the East, oaks and hickories synchronize their nut production to baffle the animals that feed on them. Word goes out, and the trees of a given species, whether they stand in sun or shade, wet or dry, bear heavily or not at all, together, as a community. Forests mend and shape themselves through subterranean synapses. And in shaping themselves, they shape, too, the tens of thousands of other linked creatures that form it from within. Maybe it's useful to think of forests as enormous, spreading, branching, underground super trees. She tells how an elm helped start the American Revolution, how a huge 500-year-old mesquite grows in the middle of one of the planet's most arid deserts, how the glimpse of a horse chestnut through a window gave Anne Frank hope, even in hopeless hiding. How seeds brought to the moon and back sprouted all over the earth. How the world is inhabited by magnificent creatures no one knows. How it may take centuries to learn as much about trees as people once knew. Her husband lives 14 miles away in town. They see each other once a day for lunches that Dennis makes from whatever is in season. All day and all night long, her only people are the trees, and her only means of speaking for them are words, those organs of saprophytic latecomers that live off the energy green things make. Journal articles have always been hard enough. Her years as an outcast come back to her each time she writes one, even when she's only one of a dozen co-authors. She feels even more anxiety when others are on board. She'd sooner retire again than inflict on these beloved colleagues anything like what she once suffered. Yet even journal articles are a walk in the woods compared to writing for the public. Scientific papers sit in archives, matters of indifference to almost everyone. But this millstone book, she's sure to be mocked and misunderstood in the press, and she'll never earn out what her publisher has already paid. All winter long, she has struggled with how to tell a stranger everything she knows. The months have been hell, but paradise, too. Soon enough, the hellish paradise will end. In August, she'll close her field lab, pack up the gear, and remove all her meticulous samples to the coast and that university where she'll, unthinkable, begin to teach again. The words refused to come tonight. She should simply sleep and see what her dreams might say. Instead, she cranes to glimpse the kitchen clock above the antique slope-shouldered refrigerator. Still time for a midnight wander down to the pond. The spruces near the cabin wave spooky prophecies under the near full moon. There's a straight line of them, the memory of a vanished fence where red crossbills once liked to sit and shit out seeds. The trees are busy tonight, fixing carbon in their dark phase. All will be in flower before long. Huckleberry and currant, showy milkweed, tall Oregon grape, yarrow and checker mallow. She marvels again at how the planet's supreme intelligence could discover calculus and the universal laws of gravitation before anyone knew what a flower was for. Tonight, the stands are as drizzled and murky as her word-filled mind. She finds the trail and ducks beneath her beloved Pseudotsuga. A path cuts under the spires lit by late winter's moon, a path she walks almost nightly, out and back, like that old palindrome, La ruta nos aportó otro paso natural. The many uncatalogued volatile compounds breathed out by needles at night slow her heart rate, soften her breathing, and if she's right, even alter her mood and thoughts. So many substances in woodland pharmacies that no one has yet identified. Powerful molecules in bark, pith, and leaves, whose effects have yet to be discovered. One family of distress hormones used by her trees, jasminate, supplies the punch to all those feminine perfumes that play on mystery and intrigue. Sniff me, love me, I'm in trouble. And they are in trouble, all these trees, all the forests of the world, even the quaintly named set-aside lands. More trouble than she has the heart to tell readers of her little book. Trouble, like the atmosphere, flows everywhere, in currents beyond the power of humans to predict or control. She pops out into the pond's clearing. The starry sky erupts above her. All the explanation a person needs for why humans have waged war on forests forever. Dennis has told her what the loggers say. Let's go let a little light into that swamp. Forests panic people. Too much going on there. Humans need a sky. Her seat is vacant and waiting, that moss-blanketed nurse log by the water's edge. The moment she looks out over the water, her head clears, and she finds the passage she's after. She has searched for a name for the great ancient trunks of the uncut forest, the ones who keep the market in carbons and metabolites going. Now she has one. Fungi mine stone to supply their trees with minerals. They hunt springtails, which they feed to their hosts. Trees, for their part, store extra sugar in their fungi's synapses to dole out to the sick and shaded and wounded. A forest takes care of itself, even as it builds the local climate it needs to survive. Before it dies, a Douglas fir, half a millennium old, will send its storehouse of chemicals back down into its roots and out through its fungal partners, donating its riches to the community pool in a last will and testament. We might well call these ancient benefactors giving trees. The reading public needs such a phrase to make the miracle a little more vivid, visible. It's something she learned long ago from her father. People see better what looks like them. Giving trees is something any generous person can understand and love. And with those two words, Patricia Westerford seals her own fate and changes the future. Even the future of trees. In the morning, she splashes cold water on her face, makes a flaxberry slurry, drinks it while reading yesterday's pages, then sits at the pine table, vowing not to stand up until she has a paragraph worthy of showing Dennis at lunch. The smell of her red cedar pencil elates her. The slow push of graphite across paper reminds her of the steady evaporation that lifts hundreds of gallons of water up hundreds of feet into a giant Douglas fir trunk every day. The solitary act of sitting over the page and waiting for her hand to move may be as close as she'll ever get to the enlightenment of plants. The final chapter eludes her. She needs some impossible trifecta, hopeful, useful, and true. She could use old Chico, that Norway spruce who lives about midway up the length of Sweden. Above the ground, the tree is only a few hundred years old, but below, in the microbe-riddled soil, he reaches back 9,000 years or more, thousands of years older than this trick of writing she uses to try to capture it. All morning long, she works to squeeze the 9,000-year saga into 10 sentences. A procession of trunks falling and springing back up from the same root. There's the hopeful she's after. The truth is somewhat more brutal. By late morning, she catches up to the present, when, for the first time, the new man-made atmosphere coaxes the latest of old Chico's usually snow-stunted Krumholtz trunks to shoot up into a full-sized tree. But hope and truth do nothing for humans without use. In the clumpy, clumsy finger-paint of words, she searches for the use of old Chico, up on that barren crest, endlessly dying and resurrecting in every change of climate. His use is to show that the world is not made for our utility. What use are we to trees? She remembers the Buddha's words, "A tree is a wondrous thing that shelters, feeds, and protects all living things. It even offers shade to the axemen who destroy it." And with those words, she has her book's end. Dennis shows at noon, reliable as rain, bearing broccoli almond lasagna, his latest midday masterpiece. She thinks, as she does several times a week, how lucky she has been to spend these few blessed years married to the one man on earth who'd let her spend most of her life alone. Game, patient, good-natured Dennis. He protects her work and needs so little. In his handyman's heart, he already knows how few things man is really the measure of, and he's as generous and eager as weeds. As they eat Dennis's feast, she reads him today's installment on Old Chico. He listens, astonished, like a happy child might listen to Greek myths. She finishes. He claps. "Oh, babe, it's just fine." Something deep in her callow green soul likes being the world's oldest babe. "I hate to tell you this, but I think you're done." It's terrifying, but he's right. She sighs and stares out the kitchen window, where three crows hatch their elaborate plans for breaking into her compost bin. "So, what do I do now?" His laugh is as hearty as if she said something funny.
"You type it up, and we mail it to your publishers. 4 months late."
"I can't."
"Why not?"
"Everything's wrong, starting with the title."
"What's wrong with How Trees Will Save the World?" "Trees won't save the world?"
"I'm sure they will, after the world shrugs us off."
He chuckles and packs up the dirty dishes. He'll take them home, where there are deep sinks, strainers, and hot water. He looks across the kitchen at her.
"Call it forest salvation. Then you don't have to commit to who's saving what."
"I do love you."
Did someone say you didn't? Look, babe, this should be pure pleasure, talking to people about your life's great joy.
You know, Den, the last time I was in the public eye, it didn't go so well.
He swipes at the air. That was another lifetime.
Wolfpack. They didn't want to disprove me. They wanted blood.
But you've been exonerated, over and over.
She wants to tell him what she has never mentioned, how the trauma of those days was so great that she cooked herself a fatal woodlands feast. But she can't. She's too ashamed of that long-dead girl. Part of her no longer entirely believes that she could ever have considered such a course. Deniable theater. A game. So she conceals the only thing she has ever kept from him. How she had the poison mushrooms all but in her mouth.
Babe, you're practically a prophetess these days.
I also spent a lot of years as a pariah. Prophetess is much more fun.
She helps him out to the car with the dirty dishes.
Love you, then.
Please stop saying that. You're spooking me.
She types up the draft. She prunes a few words and pollards a few phrases. There's now a chapter called The Giving Trees, about her beloved Doug Firs and their underground welfare state. She ranges around the country's forests, from cottonwoods that top 100 feet in a decade to bristlecone pines that die slowly for 5,000 years. Then the post office, where all her anxiety drains out of her the minute she pays the postage and sends the manuscript off to the other coast. 6 weeks later, her office phone rings. She hates the phone. Handheld schizophrenia. Unseen voices whispering to you from a distance. Nobody calls her except with unpleasant business. It's her editor, whom she has never met, from New York, a city she has never seen.
Patricia? Your book! I just finished it!
Patricia winces, waiting for the axe.
Unbelievable! Who knew that trees got up to all those things?
Well, a few 100 million years of evolution gives you a repertoire.
You make them come alive.
Actually, they were alive already.
But she's thinking of the book her father gave her when she was 14. She realizes she must dedicate this book to her father, and to her husband, and all the people who will in time turn into other things.
Patty? You wouldn't believe what you have me seeing between the subway stop and my office. That part about the giving trees? Mind-blowing! We didn't pay you enough for this.
You paid me more than I've made in the last 5 years.
You'll earn out in 2 months.
What Patricia Westerford would like to earn back is her solitude, her anonymity, which she begins to sense, the way trees can sense an invasion still far away, will never be hers again. Mastery arrives, and there's no turning back. 2 months after the game's North American release, the president, CEO, and majority stockholder of Semper Virens fires up a copy on his workhorse machine in his apartment on the floor above the company's shiny new headquarters in the foothills up Page Mill Road. It's all redwood and glass, a playground of whimsical, meditative spaces. Odd angles surround open-air atriums planted with giant Italian stone pines. Working at your carrel feels like camping out in a national park. Nile's refuge is tucked away on high, above the hive. The only way to reach it is by private elevator, hidden behind a fire stairwell. At the center of the concealed den sits a complex hospital bed. Nile almost never uses it anymore. 40 minutes to get in and out of. It feels like death these days, even to lie down. There's no time. He sleeps in his chair, rarely more than 40 minutes at a shot. Ideas torture him like the Furies. Plans and breakthroughs for his world in progress chase him around the galaxy without mercy. He sits in front of a giant screen at a work surface high enough for him to slip the chair under. Past the screen, a plate glass panorama reveals the top of Monte Bello. That view and the starscapes shining through the night skylight make up most of Nile's voyages abroad. His forays now are like today's. Expeditions down the coasts of landmasses that start out shrouded in fog and open into discovery. He designed the game's foundations, wrote a fair portion of the code, and spent months working through its possible paths. Mastery should have had no more power to surprise him, yet it never fails to quicken his pulse. A click of the mouse, a few keystrokes, and he's face to face again with the next virgin continent. In truth, the game is pathetic. It's two-dimensional. No smell, no touch, no taste, no feel. It's tiny and grainy, with a world model as simplistic as Genesis. Yet it sinks its teeth into his brainstem whenever he fires it up. The maps, climates, and scattered resources are new each time in. His opponents may be conquistadors, builders, or technocrats, nature worshippers, misers, humanitarians, or radical utopians. Nothing quite like this place has ever existed. Yet going there feels like coming home. His mind has been waiting for such a playground since long before he fell from his betraying tree. Today he chooses to be a sage. Rumor is spreading across dial-up bulletin boards from around the globe about an overpowered victory strategy players are calling enlightenment. Top-ranked leaders are pushing for the whole approach to be banned. But even as a sage, he must acquire sufficient coal, gold, ore, stone, wood, food, honor, and glory to pay for his population growth. He must explore unknown terrain, form trade routes, and raid neighboring settlements, working his way along branching trees for culture, craft, economics, and technology. The game presents almost as many meaningful choices as real life, or, as his staff has taken to calling it a little derisively, RL. This morning, the graphics look a little jagged compared to Mastery 2, already in the works. But graphics have never meant much to Nile. The visible is only a placeholder for real desire. All he and 500,000 other Mastery players need is easy and endless shape-shifting in a kingdom forever growing. Something twists in him. He takes a few minutes to recognize the feeling as hunger. He should eat, but eating is such a process. He rolls to the mini-fridge and grabs an energy drink and something that turns out to be a chicken puff, which he downs without even microwaving. Tonight he'll make a real meal, or tomorrow. He's assembling a stack of cypress planks from his best team of woodcutters into a mammoth ark when the phone rings. His morning appointment with a journalist who wants to interview the infant industry's rising star. The boy still in his 20s who has made a home for so many homeless boys. This reporter sounds not much older than his subject, and petrified. Mr. Mehta? Mr. Mehta is his father, whom Nile has tucked away in a tiny palace outside Cupertino, complete with pool, home theater, and a pond flanked by a rosewood mandir, where Mrs. Mehta does weekly puja and prays to the gods to bring her son happiness and a girl who'll see him for who he is. A reflection in the plate glass looks up to challenge him. A brown, scrawny, praying mantis with bulbous joints and enormous, tight-skinned skull for a head. Call me Nile.
Oh, gosh. Okay. Wow. Neela, I'm Chris. Thanks for talking. So, first, I want to ask, did you know that Mastery was going to be such a hit?
Neela did know, long before the game was released into the wild. He knew from the moment he had the idea, under the giant, spreading, pulsing tree at night up on Skyline.
Kind of. Yes. The beta release stopped my workforce dead. My project manager had to enforce a ban.
Holy crap! Do you have sales figures?
It's selling very well, in 14 countries.
Why do you think that is?
The game's success is simple enough. It's a reasonable facsimile of the place Neela envisioned at 7, when his father first lugged an enormous cardboard box up the apartment stairs.
Now, Neela-ji, what might this little creature do?
What the boy wanted the black box to do was innocent enough. Return him to the days of myth and origin, when all the places a person could reach were green and pliant, and life might still be anything at all.
I don't know. It has simple rules. The world responds to you. Things happen faster than in life. You can watch your empire grow.
I confess to you, I'm totally in love. Last night, when I finally stopped playing, it was like 4 a.m. I just needed to see what would happen with one more move. And when I stood up from the screen, my whole bedroom was bobbing and jittering.
I know what you mean.
And Neela does, except for the part about standing up.
Do you think it's changing the brains of the people who play it?
Yes, Chris. But so does everything, I think.
Did you see the article in last week's Times about game addiction? People spending 50 hours a week on video games?
Mastery isn't a video game. It's a thought game.
Okay, but you must admit a lot of productive time is going to waste.
The game is definitely chronophagic.
He hears a little question mark pop up in a thought bubble on the other end of the line.
Time-eating.
Does it bother you to be such a destroyer of productivity?
Neela gazes out on a patch of mountain shaved bare half a century ago.
I don't think it might not be so bad to destroy a little productivity.
Huh. Okay. The game's killing my little life anyway. I keep coming across things that aren't in the 128-page game book.
Yes. That's part of what keeps people playing.
While I'm in the game, I feel I have a goal. Always something more to do.
Yes. Oh, yes, Neela wants to tell him. Safe and comprehensible, with no swamps of ambiguity to suck you down, no human-on-human darkness, and your own will receives its rightful land. Call it meaning.
I think a lot of people feel more at home in there than they do out here.
Maybe. A lot of guys my age, anyway.
Yes. But we're planning all kinds of new roles for the next release. New ways of playing the game. Avenues of possibility for all kinds of people. We want it to be a beautiful place for everyone.
Wow. Okay. That's wild. So what will the company do next?
The company is slipping out of Neela's control. Teams and managers populate an organizational tree he can't keep track of. The best developers in the valley knock on the door every day, wanting to play. Software engineers on Route 128 around Boston. Recent grads from Georgia Tech and Carnegie Mellon. Brains shaped from infancy by the games Neela used to give away beg him for the chance to help engineer the wholesale exodus now well underway.
I wish I could tell you.
Chris whimpers.
How about if I beg?
His voice has all the confidence of a healthy, ambulatory male. Probably white and good-looking. the charm and optimism of a guy who does not yet know what people will do to other people, to other living things, once terrors and hurts and needs set in.
Just a hint?
Well, it's simple, really. More of everything. More surprises, more possibilities, more places filled with more kinds of creatures. Imagine mastery after it doubles in richness and complexity 40 times. We don't even know what such a place might look like.
All from a seed this big.
Oh, that's so amazing, so beautiful.
Something stabs at Nile. He wants to say, ask me again, there's more.
Can I ask about you?
Nile's pulse spikes, like he's trying to lift himself on his set of exercise rings.
Please no, please don't.
Of course. I read quite a few stories about you. Your own employees call you a hermit.
I'm not a hermit. It's just my legs don't work.
I read about that. How do you run the company?
Phone? Email? Online messaging?
Why are there no pictures of you?
It isn't pretty.
The answer flusters Chris. Nile wants to say, it's all right. It's only RL.
Do you feel that growing up as the child of immigrants...
Oh, I don't think so. Probably no.
No what?
I don't think it had much of an influence on me.
But how about being Indian American? Don't you feel that...
Here's what I think. I've been Gandhi and Hitler and Chief Joseph. I've wielded +6 great swords while wearing little chainmail thonged bikinis that frankly didn't give me all that much protection.
Chris laughs. It's a beautiful, confident laugh. Nile doesn't care what the man looks like. He doesn't care if he's 400 pounds and covered in cold sores. Desire rushes him.
Would you like to go out together sometime?
But going out would have to be going in. Nothing needs to happen. Nothing could happen, in fact. That's all gone. We could just sit together somewhere, talk about all things, no fear, no hurt, no consequences. Just sit and talk about where people are going.
Impossible. One look at Nile's grotesque limbs, and even this confident, laughing journalist would be disgusted. Yet this man, Chris, he loves Nile's game. He plays it all night and into morning. The code Nile wrote is changing this other man's brain.
It's just this. I've been lots of things. I've lived all over, in Stone Age Africa, and on the outer rim of other galaxies. I think that soon enough, not right away, but soon, if software keeps getting better and giving us more room, I think that we'll be able to make ourselves into anything we want.
That sounds a little out there.
Yes, maybe it is.
Games aren't. People will still want money. They'll still want prestige and social status. Politics, that's forever.
Yes. Forever? Maybe.
Nile stares into his screen, a world coming on hard, where social status will accrue entirely by votes in a space that is at once instant, global, anonymous, virtual, and merciless.
People still have bodies. They want real power. Friends and lovers, rewards, accomplishments.
Sure. But soon we'll carry all of that around in our pockets. We'll live and trade and make deals and have love affairs, all in symbol space. The world will be a game, with on-screen scores.
And all this?
He waves, as people do on phones, even knowing Chris can't see him. All the things you say people really want? Real life? Soon, we won't even remember how it used to go. A car heads north on Highway 36. Impala, going too fast by 10 as it crests the rise. Down the long incline, a dozen black crates in the road block the way forward. Coffins. The driver brakes and brings the car to a stop a few feet in front of the mass funeral. In the air above the coffins, on a traverse line cabled between two trees as stout as lighthouses, a mountain lioness climbs. A harness hugs her tawny waist, clipped by carabiner to a safety cable. Her tail swishes between sleek hind haunches, and her noble, whiskered head lolls on her neck as she inspects a snagged banner. A second car comes from the south. Rabbit, skidding to a stop in front of the coffins. It honks twice before the driver notices the cougar. The sight is odd enough, even here in Ganja Land, that the driver is happy for a minute just to gawk. The animal is young, live, and clothed only in a body stocking, with the words, "A change is gonna come," on her shoulder, peeking out from under the leotard. The cat fights with the banner. The drivers wait, curious. Another car gets trapped behind the northbound one, then another. On a roadside platform, a bear tugs on a leader, trying to pull the snagged bedsheet across its guy wire. The grizzly's snout and sunken eyes are gloriously painted papier-mâché. His eye holes are so small that the bear must wag its great muzzle to see anything. In a few more minutes, traffic starts to back up in both directions. Two guys get out of their cars. They're irate, but can't help laughing at the megafauna. A swipe of the cougar's paw, and the sheet finally drops, catches the wind, and flaps above the highway like a sail. Stop sacrificing virgins. The borders teem with fronds and flowers from the margins of a medieval manuscript. For a moment, the blocked commuters can only look. A few trapped drivers break into spontaneous applause. Someone calls from a roll-down window, "I'll help you with your virginity problem, honey." High above the roadway, the cougar waves. The hostages gesture back, thumbs or middle fingers. Her wild mask, gazing down from above, stirs some ancient hoo-ha into the spectator's viscera. One of the drivers charges the coffins. "My timber job pays for your welfare checks. Get the hell out of the road!" He kicks at the black boxes, but they don't budge. From a choker around her neck, the cougar produces a whistle and toots three blasts. The crates open all together, and bodies rise like it's the last day. The bear adds to the chaos by tossing smoke bombs. Creatures emerge from each coffin, decked out in the colors of creation. There's an elk, whose antlers arc outward like angel wings. A Sonoma chipmunk with giant chopstick incisors. An Anna's hummingbird flashing hot pink and iridescent bronze. A Dalí nightmare of Pacific giant salamander, a sunny yellow blob of banana slug. The blocked drivers laugh at the animal resurrection. More applause and another round of profanity. The animals break into a wild dance. It unnerves the motorists. They've seen this bacchanal before, animals scampering in crazy circles, holdover memory from the illustrated pages of the first books they ever rubbed their fingers across, back when all things were possible and real. In the distraction of the animal dance, the bear and cougar unhook their harnesses and scramble down from their perches. When a police siren whoops from the rear of the backed-up cars, it sounds at first like another sideshow. The police slink up the blocked road's shoulder, giving the animals plenty of time to scatter into the understory. As they do, an older woman and a man with a video camera strapped to his palm disappear into the woods behind them. 2 days later, the film hits the national news. Reaction runs the living spectrum. The banner slingers are heroes. They're grandstanding criminals who ought to be locked up. They're animals. Animals, yes. Big-brained, altruistic, animal con artists who managed to block a state highway for a while and make it seem like wild things might have their way. 4 years at Fortuna College come down to one afternoon. Adam, in his spot in the front row, Daniel's auditorium. Professor Ruben Rabinowski at the podium. Affect and Cognition. Last lecture before the final exam, and the Rabbi man is surveying all the experimental evidence that suggests, to the delight of the oversubscribed class, that teaching psychology is a waste of time. Now I'll show you the self-evaluations of people asked how susceptible they think they are to anchoring, causal base rate errors, the endowment effect, availability, belief perseverance, confirmation, illusory correlation, cueing, all the biases you've learned about in this course. Here are the scores of the control group. And here are the scores of people who've taken this course in previous years. Lots of laughs. The numbers are pretty much the same. Both groups confident of their iron will, clear vision, and independent thought. Here are the performances on several different evaluations designed to conceal what they were testing. Most of the second group were tested less than 6 months after they took this course. The laughter turns to groans. Blindness and unreason, rampant. Course grads working twice as hard to save $5 as they would to earn it. Grads fearing bears, sharks, lightning, and terrorists more than they fear drunk drivers. 80% thinking they're smarter than average. Grads wildly inflating how many jelly beans they think are in a jar, based purely on someone else's ridiculous guesses. The psyche's job is to keep us blissfully ignorant of who we are, what we think, and how we'll behave in any situation. We're all operating in a dense fog of mutual reinforcement. Our thoughts are shaped primarily by legacy hardware that evolved to assume that everyone else must be right. But even when the fog is pointed out, we're no better at navigating through it. So why, you may ask, do I go on talking up here? Why go on, year after year, cashing the college's checks? The laughs are all sympathy now. Adam admires the brilliant pedagogy. He, at least, he vows, will remember this lecture a year from now, and its revelations will make him wiser, no matter what the studies show. He, at least, will defy the indicting numbers. Let me show you the answers you yourselves gave to a simple questionnaire I had you fill out at the beginning of the semester. You've probably forgotten you ever took it. The professor glances at the average answers and grimaces. His lips tighten in pain. Snickers across the room. You may or may not recall that I asked you then whether you thought you'd... Professor Rabinowski fiddles with his tie. He windmills with his left arm, grimaces again. Excuse me 1 minute. He lurches off the dais and out the door. A murmur passes through the auditorium. Thuds come from down the hall, a stack of boxes tipping over. 54 students sit and wait for the punchline. Faint, swallowed sounds fill the hallway, but no one moves. Adam scans the seats behind him. Students frown at each other or busy themselves with notes. He turns to look at that magnificent woman who always sits 2 seats to his left, pre-med, fawn-colored, pretty without knowing it, binders full of neat handwritten notes, and he thinks again how glorious it would be to sit in Bucky's over a beer with her and talk about this astonishing class. But the semester ends in 2 days, and the chance is as good as lost. She glances his way, confused. He shakes his head and can't help smirking. He leans in to whisper, and she reciprocates. Maybe the chance hasn't vanished.
Kitty Genovese, The Bystander Effect, Darley and Latine, 1968.
But is he okay? Her breath is like cinnamon.
Remember how we had to answer whether we'd help someone who...
A woman shouts from below for someone to call an ambulance. But by the time the paramedics get their ambulance onto the quad, Professor Rabinowski is dead of a myocardial infarction.
I don't understand, the pre-med beauty says in their booth at Bucky's. If you thought he was demonstrating the bystander effect, why did you keep sitting there?
She's on her third iced coffee, and it bothers Adam. That's not the point. The question is why 53 other people, including you, who thought he was having a heart attack, didn't do anything. I thought he was jerking us around to make a point.
Then you should have been on your feet and calling his bluff.
I didn't want to spoil the show.
You should have been up in 5 seconds.
He slams the booth table. It wouldn't have made any damn difference. She flinches into the booth, like he meant to hit her. He puts up his palms, leans toward her to apologize, and she flinches again. He freezes, hands in the air, seeing what the cowering woman sees. I'm sorry. You're right. Professor Rabinowski's last lesson. Learning psychology is indeed pretty much useless. He pays for the drinks and leaves. He never sees her again, except for the following week, from 4 seats away, for 2 hours, at the proctored final exam. He's admitted to the new social psychology graduate program down at Santa Cruz. The campus is an enchanted garden perched on a mountainside overlooking Monterey Bay. It's the worst place he can imagine for finishing a doctorate or doing any real work whatsoever. On the other hand, it's perfect for making interspecies contact with sea lions down by the pier, climbing the sunset tree, naked and stoned at night, and lying on his back in the great meadow, searching for a thesis topic in the mad clouds of stars. After 2 years, the other grads take to calling him Bias Boy. In any discussion of the psychology of social formations, Adam Apich, Master of Science, is there with several studies that show how legacy cognitive blindness will forever prevent people from acting in their own best interests. He consults with his advisor, Professor Mieke van Dijk, she of the sublime Dutch bob, clipped consonants, and soft-core softened vowels. In fact, she makes him confer with her every 2 weeks in her office up in College 10, hoping the enforced check-in will jumpstart his research.
You are dragging your feet over nothing.
In fact, he has had his feet up, reclining on her Victorian daybed across the office from her desk, as if she's psychoanalyzing him. It amuses them both.
Dragging? Not at all. I am utterly paralyzed.
But why? You make too big a deal about this. Think of a thesis.
She can't pronounce the TH.
As a long seminar project. You don't have to save the world.
I don't? Can I at least save a nation-state or two?
She laughs. Her wide overbite quickens his pulse.
Listen, Adam. Pretend this has nothing to do with your career. Nothing to do with any professional approval. What do you, personally, want to discover? What would give you enjoyment to study for a couple of years?
He watches the words spill from that pretty mouth, free from the social scientific jargon that she tends to drop into in seminars.
This enjoyment you speak about, you want to know something.
He wants to know whether she has ever even once thought of him sexually. It isn't inconceivable. She's only a decade older than he is, and she is, he wants to say, robust.
He feels a weird need to tell her how he got here in her office looking for a thesis topic. Wants to draw his entire intellectual history in a straight line, from daubing nail polish on the abdomens of ants to watching his beloved undergraduate mentor die, then ask her where the line leads next.
I'm interested in unblinding.
He steals a look at her. If only people, like some invertebrates, would just turn raging purple when they felt attraction, it would make the entire species so much less neurotic. She purses her lips. She must know how good that looks on her.
Unblinding? I'm sure that must mean something.
Can people come to independent moral decisions that run counter to their tribe's beliefs?
You want to study transformative potential as a function of strong normative in-group favoritism.
He'd nod, but the jargon bugs the crap out of him.
It's like this. I think of myself as a good man, a good citizen, but say I'm a good citizen of early Rome, when a father had the power and sometimes the duty to put his child to death.
I see. And you, a good citizen, are motivated to preserve positive distinctiveness.
We're trapped by social identity, even when there are big, huge truths staring us in.
He hears his peers jeering, "Bias, boy."
Well, no, clearly not, or in-group realignment would never happen. Transformation of social identity.
Does it?
Of course. Here in America, people went from believing that women are too frail to vote to having a major party vice presidential candidate in one lifetime, from Dred Scott to emancipation in a few years. Children, foreigners, prisoners, women, blacks, the disabled and mentally ill. They've all gone from property to personhood. I was born at a time when the idea of a chimpanzee getting a hearing in a court of law seemed totally absurd. By the time you're my age, we'll wonder how we ever denied such animals their standing as intelligent creatures.
How old are you, anyway?
Professor Van Dyck laughs. Her fine, high cheekbones pink out. He's sure of it. Tough to hide with that complexion.
Topic, please.
I'd like to determine the personality factors that make it possible for some individuals to wonder how everyone can be so blind
while everyone else is still trying to stabilize in-group loyalties. Now we get somewhere. This could be a topic. With much more narrowing and definition, you could look at the next step in this same historical progression of consciousness. Study those people who support a position that any reasonable person in our society thinks is crazy.
For instance,
we are living at a time when claims are being made for a moral authority that lies beyond the human.
One smooth tensing of his abdominal muscles, and he sits up.
What do you mean?
You've seen the news. People up and down this coast are risking their lives for plants. I read a story last week. A man who had his legs sheared off by a machine he tried to chain himself to.
Adam has seen the stories, but he ignored them. Now he can't see why.
Plant rights? Plant personhood?
A boy he knew once jumped into a hole and risked live burial to protect his unborn brother's sapling from harm. That boy is dead.
I hate activists.
So? Why?
Orthodoxy and sloganeering? Boring. I hate it when those Greenpeace guys shake me down on the street. Anyone who gets righteous doesn't understand.
Understand what?
how hopelessly fragile and wrong we all are about everything.
Professor Van Dijk frowns.
I see. Good thing we aren't doing a psychological study of you.
Are these people really appealing to a new non-human moral order? Or are they just being sentimental about pretty green things?
That's where controlled psychological measurements come in.
He smirks a little himself, but something large wells up in him, and he can't even shift his weight or it will disappear. A way forward.
Identity formation and big five personality factors among plants' rights activists.
Or, who does the tree hugger really hug when he hugs a tree?
The sun shines on the Western Cascades as Mimi and Douglas pull onto the car-packed Forest Service road. Bodies mill about the small clearing. This isn't a protest march, it's a carnival. The ceramic mold manager asks the wounded vet, "Who are all these people?"
Dougie steps from the car with that stupid, air-eating, sun-eating grin Mimi has come to enjoy, the way you might enjoy the yips of a dog you've rescued from the pound. He waves his work-gnarled hands across the crowd in goofy cowboy joy.
"Homo sapiens, man! Always up to something!"
Mimi trots to catch up with him. The turnout dizzies her.
"What they do?"
Douglas leans his good ear toward her.
"How's that?"
The crowd is loud in the circus of their cause, and he's lost a lot of hearing from his days in transport planes. It still surprises her, a man who bothers to listen.
"My father used to say that. What they do?"
"What they do?"
"Yeah, meaning, what the hell do those people hope to accomplish?"
"Was he strange?"
"Chinese. He believed English should be more efficient than it is."
Douglas smacks his forehead.
"You're Chinese!"
"Half Chinese. What did you think?"
"I don't know, something swarthier."
The real question, Mimi knows, is what she do. She's amazed he managed to get her up here for this protest. Her only previous political action was a grade school vendetta against Chairman Mao. Her grudge is with the city, its scheming nighttime raid against her pines. As for these trees, so far out of town, she's an engineer for crying out loud. These trees are calling out to be used. But a pair of lectures and a visit to an organizational meeting, accompanied by this clumsy innocent, have broken her heart. These mountains, these forest cascades, now that she has seen them, they're hers. So here she is, at a public demonstration that would have made her emigrant father come pluck her home in fear of deportation, torture, or worse. Look at everyone. It's grannies with guitars and toddlers with space-age water pistols. College students out to prove themselves worthy of one another. Preppers pushing baby carriages like all-terrain Hobbit Humvees. Grade school kids carrying earnest placards. "Respect your elders. We need our lungs." A rainbow alliance of assorted footwear makes its way up the trunk to the hall road. Loafers and cross-trainers, backward-sloping sandals, cracked-toe Chuck Taylors, and, yes, logger calks. The clothes are still more varied. Button-down Oxfords and priest-dressed jeans, tie-dye and flannel, hickory shirts, even a U.S. Air Force flight jacket, like the one Dougie pawned for a few bucks 15 years ago. Clown suits, swimsuits, jumpsuits, every kind of suit, except three-piecers. Much of the crowd has been bussed to the site by four wildly different environmental outfits that tend to go to war with one another when there's no closer target.
A group of backpackers took 2 days making their way overland to join this spectacle, all trying to bail out the ocean of capitalism with an acorn cap. A handful of locals show up to watch. Out this far, most of the people in a 100-mile radius exist by grace of timber. They have their hand-lettered signs as well. Loggers, the real